Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women. Health, beauty, and well-being, and sometimes sex. Listen to Radio Gorgeous every day. Bad days. We all have crises, death, divorce or problems with children as well, which can bring on terrible stress and can lead to a visit to your GP and take a low-level dose of antidepressants. But what if your condition is much worse than that? Rachel Kelly was not expecting what happened to her. A Times journalist with a loving husband living in Notting Hill Gate with two beautiful young children and no deep worries. Rachel is here on Radio Gorgeous today to talk about Black Rainbow, how words healed me through depression. Rachel, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thanks very much.
So Rachel, you went from Notting Hill Gate journalist and a yummy mummy to complete nervous breakdown in 3 days.
Yeah, it was very striking how quickly it happened. It took us all by surprise. It started with one sleepless night and it escalated extremely quickly. I started having very frightening and painful physical symptoms. It started on a Wednesday, and by the Friday, I was in a fetal curl on the floor and I couldn't move and I was screaming and I had to be sedated.
Obviously, you were in total mental torture, but it physically affected you, didn't it?
Yes, I had no idea that depression could be like this. I actually thought I was having a heart attack. When we went to hospital and our GP told us to go and see a psychiatrist is what we did, I thought they'd made a mistake. And I thought, maybe I've got to go and see a cardiologist. Maybe I was having a heart attack. I had such extreme physical symptoms. My stomach was clenched up. It was completely knotted. I could hardly eat. I was having trouble breathing. My head, I felt like I was being stung by wasps. My whole brain was under attack. And I later discovered that actually that this is quite commonplace and depression does have very severe physical symptoms. And in fact, I learned that one psychiatrist who himself suffered depression said that if he had to compare a heart attack, renal failure and a severe depressive episode, he'd said that the pain of a severe depressive episode was worse than the other two.
So is it, how can a psychological pain come up in the body? I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, my psychiatrist did explain it to me. It took a while because I was so ill, I couldn't understand anything for a few weeks. But as I began slowly to be able to understand, he very gradually began to explain what happens to the body. And basically, I suffer from anxiety. I'm a happy person and I don't suffer from low mood and I'm actually very blessed, but I am anxious and I was very overwhelmed. I'd taken on too much. And basically what happened is that my body had gone into a sort of fight or flight and it had just gone into this kind of emergency reaction, but it didn't ever stop. The way I describe it, if you haven't experienced it, is if you've ever been on a plane and then they suddenly say, you know, get into the crash landing position
brace,
or whatever.
Brace, yeah.
Exactly. It's like that feeling. It's like your heart starts to race, you feel breathless, your stomach knots up. And I had this really strong sensation of falling, like this trapdoor had opened inside me and I was falling and I was just desperate to hold on to something. And in fact, I was literally holding on to something because I was lying in bed and I had my mother in one hand and my husband in the other and I was just holding on for dear life. And it was just this very extreme physical agony. And that was why I wanted to commit suicide. It wasn't because I didn't have a nice life. I actually have a very nice life and I'm a very lucky person. But because of the physical pain, and I just couldn't stand it any longer.
I've got to a section in the book where you say you're fantasizing about slitting your wrists and the feeling of blood would be so fantastic.
I just was so worn out. I just thought I couldn't go on. I'd done what I could. I had my children, I had a lovely marriage, I'd had a good career at the Times, and actually I'd had enough. I couldn't put up with the physical pain anymore. And I was amazed actually when I got through what they call the sort of critical period and I did start to get better, that it had only been 6 weeks in this critical period. I literally thought I'd been ill for months and months and months.
Over 1,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on @radio_gorgeous. On Twitter, darling, of course. Mwah.
I think probably my lowest moment was, even though I was totally resigned to the fact that it was better to die because I'd get out of the pain, I did go to hospital. I got much worse. So I then came back and was being treated at home. You know, that was lovely in a way, but I could every now and again hear the children downstairs. And don't want to get too teary, but there were moments when I heard the children and, you know, like any mother, I did want to be there for my children. And that was very, I think that was my worst moment, when I thought that I might never be well again and I might never be able to look after my children. And this hadn't happened to us before and we didn't know anything about depression. So, I mean, my psychiatrist kept saying, you will get better, but I didn't know that I'd get better. So that was very desperate.
I mean, obviously you're here to talk about the poetry, which we're going to go on to. But what actual drugs did they put you on in the end?
There's absolutely no way. There's a lot of discussion about antidepressants and do they work and don't they work. I mean, if you are suffering an acute depressive episode, there is no way you're not going to take drugs. Mm. I mean, it would be like saying to someone, don't take drugs for cancer or diabetes. I mean, there's nothing else when you're acutely ill. And I did then find lots of other strategies. And there are lots of things you can do, sort of self-care and looking after yourself. And as you say, I've got a bit of a thing about poetry. It doesn't work for everyone, but something that I like. But there's no way that I was well enough when I was first ill. So I did take drugs, and I actually took quite an old-fashioned antidepressant, because my kind of depression, as I say to you, it wasn't like low mood. It was this very heightened anxiety, which is quite a common kind of depression, especially at the moment when, you know, we have a lot of demands on ourselves. We put a lot of demands on ourselves, and we're all trying to be everything and to good mums and working hard and, you know, good wives and good friends and daughters. And I was like that. I was quite an anxious driver. And so my thing was anxiety leading to this very serious depression. And so I took a sort of sedating, quite old-fashioned antidepressant. It's called Prothiazide. It's not that commonly prescribed, but it's different to the ones like Prozac, which are when people suffer low mood.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good for you.
No. I was like completely off the scale. So I had to come down.
Yes.
The problem with antidepressants, I found, is that they're quite blunt instruments, and I think they do work. I mean, that I know a bit more about it, you know, having had 16 years of it, but my understanding is they work between about 30 to 50% of cases.
Only that.
What tends to work better is if you combine them with other approaches like therapy. Mm. And, you know, in terms of what works, it's really hard because you don't really know what's working. No. I mean, was it the therapy? Was it the drugs? I then became very interested in diet and diet for, you know, dealing with anxiety. I became much more conscious of exercise, and I had loads of therapy. And, you know, who knows exactly what one thing triggered it. But the problem for me was, when I did start the drugs, is that they basically completely knocked me out, because I'm tiny. I'm sort of 5'2". I mean, I take them and I just sort of keel over. And then gradually my doctor was very skilled, and this is what normally happens, is that you sort of try and get the right dose and you even out the picture frame. So a little bit here, a little bit up, a little bit down.
How many mg were you taking in the end?
Oh, goodness. What happened was, we gradually worked up. So I think I started at 5 and then up to 10, and I think I ended up on about 30 milligrams. But goodness, it was quite a long time ago, so I will have to double check that.
I went to your book launch last night. It was really good. You did that very fast. You type very fast. I mean, are you a kind of fast, speedy person?
Yeah, I'm definitely, you know, to-do list, tick them off, get them done, you know, anxious driver, you know, get the cupcakes, you know, run the mother's race, you know, write an article, cook dinner, have people round. I'm very, I'm not manic depressive in the sense that, as I say, I don't really go for low mood. I really consider myself quite a cheerful, happy person, and I definitely have lots of lovely things in my life. But I probably have got a slight manic element of you know.
You could say dynamic. I mean, why not?
Yeah, well, that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. I think when it's good, it's fantastic. Mm. But you don't want to sort of flip that anxious striving. And I think that's very common, and I see it a lot with my girlfriends. Is, you know, we are such strivers, you know, we keep trying to please, we're trying to do the best we can. And I think that one of the things I've tried to learn is kind of, you know, good enough is really good.
That's very interesting you said that, because I was going to say, are you a perfectionist?
Completely. Absolute perfectionist. And I think, you know, I think I went to a very competitive all-girls school, which was great in some ways. But again, I think underlying it, I felt I wasn't quite good enough and I had to try harder, and always been a bit of a striver. And, you know, in the end, I just took on too much. And in retrospect, we didn't realise it at the time, but I was in the newsroom at the Times. My husband was working for Goldman Sachs. He just stood for Parliament. We had two small, tiny children. We'd moved up to Manchester where my husband had been campaigning. And, you know, actually, a blind baby might have told you that that was quite a lot of things to be doing all at once. We didn't see it, and I seemed to be okay. And, you know, and then it just suddenly bang. So I'm a bit of a cautionary tale for not doing too
Radio
much.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
Now, I'm interested because you say nobody in my family knew about mental illness. Well, it's usually very genetic.
Well, you're quite right. I mean, then what happened is, of course, once it had happened and had this major depressive episode, unfortunately, I did get better. Then I had a second major depressive episode. And then basically the depression put in really quite deep roots. And that's what I've been dealing with. But I am much better. Mm. But anyway, in this process of trying to kind of get on top of it and deal with it and manage it, which is where I really think I'm at now, I became obviously very interested in it. And I began to realise there were lots of clues around, which I don't know how I hadn't spotted before, but basically I did realise that one very close family member has definitely got depression. And amazingly, she's from a generation that didn't recognise it and didn't treat it. And, you know, I feel very lucky that it is now something which we do know much more about. And actually, again, you know, we've got five children, and I now realise that, you know, there are vulnerabilities among some of our children. There are tendencies there, similar tendencies, and I think some of the perfectionism is sort of genetic. I think some of the tendency to sort of try and please. And again, what I think I've understood is that if you have a sort of underlying tendency, and look, some people are fine and they can take on a lot and brilliant, and also they can deal with their anxiety and they can go for a run and they're fine. Yeah. And fantastic. And I've got lots of friends like that. But for others of us, if you do have a kind of underlying tendency to it, and then you put it in a context in which you are demanding too much of yourself, or the world is demanding too much of you, or whatever it is, it can blow up. And you put the two together, and it's, you know, explosive. And I suppose that's why I feel so passionately about it, because I do feel, you know, be careful. You know, your health can massively let you down. And once it's established itself, it, you know, the pattern with depression is if you've had one episode, each episode is slightly worse.
Yeah, apparently there's sort of a track in your brain, but it can go quicker down, you know.
Exactly. It's like a slide. Yeah. And those neural pathways are there to be sort of slid down again. So this is why I'm so keen on trying to have come up with strategies to manage it so it doesn't happen again. Because certainly for me, the first episode was about 6 months and the second episode was a year. And I liken it to like a watercolour. Each time the colours are a bit darker and it's a bit more severe. Yeah. And I know for me that I have to watch it, because it could be any trigger.
It'd be happiness as well as sadness, because they say that in bipolar.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
Excitement on any level, you know.
That's really interesting, because I've been really so overwhelmed, the response to my book, and I you know, it seems to be doing well, and I'm, you know, very happy with it. But it's very interesting, because I keep quoting Kipling, if you can success and failure and treat those two imposters just the same. And just to kind of treat steady through that, because I suppose one of the things I do believe is that, just as I wasn't worthless or hopeless before when I was depressed and unable to do anything, which was a very long period, you know, I was still valid. And just because now my book seems to be doing well.
You're all fabulous, darling.
Yeah exactly. Mm. That's a trap too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so special.
Yeah.
And that makes you very vulnerable as well. So if you can keep sort of steady and in the middle, and a sort of balanced sense that, you know, you are who you are, you're okay who you are, you're good enough who you are, and you're neither so fabulous and gorgeous and, you know, darling, darling, or, you know, I'm at the bottom of my bed and I can't move. Somehow to get to this kind of midpoint.
And do you think you knew who you were?
I've become much more self-aware. I've had lots of therapy. I actually have had three separate therapists, and it took me a long time to find someone.
Right.
Yeah, which again, I've not since learned is very common. And I'm much more self-aware, and I'm much more able to spot the patterns. And I likened it to treating myself a bit like a nervous pet. So I can see the patterns, and there's certain triggers like insomnia, overwhelm, doing too much, which I know are sort of warning signs, and I'm much more careful. And I do lots of other things, like I'm very careful what I eat.
Do you want to tell us a bit about what you eat?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not extreme, but, you know, I mean, I love Diet Coke, but Diet Coke is not a good idea if you're an anxious type person.
So do you allow yourself one a week or something?
You know what I do? It sounds really stupid. I order it and then I just have it there. And I might take a sip, but I never really drink it. But somehow I feel I've kind of got my treat, but I don't really touch it because I know that afterwards I'll be really wired. And
what, just from one Diet Coke?
Well, I don't know. Again, maybe it's being small or something. But, yeah. You know, I mean, or equally a big sugary kick kind of makes you quite jittery afterwards. Mm. Alcohol's another one.
Yeah,
I mean,
do you
not
drink at all now?
I don't drink at all, no. I mean, I know, again, you know, my husband says, don't you take all these pharmaceutical drugs? Why don't you just have a glass
Radio
of wine?
Gorgeous, we are your new best friend. Monsieur, crois au Dieu, même quand tout nous semble odieux, que notre cœur est mis à sang et à feu. Fille du bonheur de peur, se sauve comme une petite souris dans un monde à l'ouvre, à bien se voir. RadioGorgeous.com.
I mean, okay, so last night, so it was after the book launch, and I was pretty wired, and it had all been very exciting, and Boris had done a poem, and it was all really exciting, and I was very, you know, fizzy head, some of the symptoms that, if I'm not careful, but I did some of my techniques. I do work with mindfulness, which can be great, and some of the breathing, and I do recite my poems and they keep me steady. But then I was up at 4, and insomnia is something which I have learnt to manage, which is that the main thing for me is that missing the sleep itself isn't the problem. The problem is worrying about it and getting myself in a state. And so I was up at 4. Probably lots of your listeners are up at 4. Yeah. And so I do some of my tricks. So I went downstairs and I made myself a hot milk. I got my oat cakes, had a piece of turkey in the fridge. It's got the old, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how you pronounce it. Tryptophan.
Yes, sounds a scary word, isn't it?
You know, but it brings you down. So yeah, I just kind of had my snack, settled down, you know, ate mindfully, not in a rush, just calmed down.
Yeah.
I knew I was awake. I went back up. I was more settled because I'd eaten and
you,
you know. I sometimes listen to poetry, and I've made an app that goes with the book, and so I've got the poems on the app and bits of healing prose that help me. And
has it got your voice on it?
No, I was so lucky actually, because as you know, I'm giving all my author proceeds of the book, and indeed the app, are going to two mental health charities, because you know, it's really dire at the moment with cuts which have fallen disproportionately on mental health services, as because mental health is still the poor relation in the NHS. So charities are filling in the gaps. So I wanted to support these charities, and people volunteered. So I've got the prose is read by Martin Lewis, who's got this lovely soothing voice. And then I wanted actors who I felt had sort of lived and been through the wars. So I got Julian Glover and Isla Blair, who are a brilliant husband and wife team, very distinguished Royal Shakespeare Company actors. But they've got these lovely, wise, soothing, peaceful voices. And then basically what I've done is I've divided the poems into the sort of four sections that would mirror a depressive episode. So there's the ones to describe the desperate times, which in itself can sometimes be helpful. Also, sometimes if you're really not feeling well, you might want to give them a poem, say, look, this is what it feels like. I can't put it into words. I lost any power of expression. I mean, it started actually when there's an Anne Sexton poem which is in the book, which is a really desperate description. There's one line in it though which really sums it up for me, which is this sense of falling, which is so hard to describe, this sense that you need to have something to hang on to. I mean, it is strong stuff, so I won't read very much of it, but I would love to read this bit about falling. It says, God went out of me as if the sun dried up, like sandpaper, as if the sun became a latrine. I kept saying, I've got to have something to hold on to. People gave me Bibles, crucifixes, a yellow daisy, but I could not touch them. I, who was a house full of bowel movement, I, who was a defaced altar. The thing is, at the height of a depressive episode, you won't be well enough to explain what it's like to someone or how desperate it is. And someone gave this poem to my husband because he was completely at sea and he just didn't know what was going on. And he said, look, this is what's happening for Rachel right now. This is what it's like. So I don't read this one now if I'm wanting consolation, but in a different kind of way, it can be quite handy just to describe it. We've got the section of when you're in crisis, and that's handy if you want to try and explain it to someone else. Then we've got the section of sort of beginning to try and get better. And one of the ways that I found it poetry very helpful was this idea of sort of trying to change the dialogue in your head. So when I was in the height of this depressive episode, I had such a negative story in my head. And literally a poem can tell you a different story and can give you a different set of words that you can repeat. And often
a mantra.
Healing mantras. You know, Apollo was the god of poetry, the god of medicine. I mean, it's a long tradition. And there's even a bit of neuroscience about it now. So one of the ways it can work is that a poem can require your concentration and it can root you in the moment. So one of the characters of depression is that you're either regretting the past or you're worried about the future, but you're not in the moment. And this is how mindfulness works. So one of my favourite poets is George Herbert. And so he was a 17th century poet. He's known as Holy Mr. Herbert, almost certainly had depression. And he is extraordinary because in his poem Love, it describes it. The first two lines really sum it up. It says, love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. And to me, this was the debate in my head. There was the feeling of this awful illness, the feeling of being guilty of dust and sin. And I think this is very common in depression, guilty, especially for me, because I sort of, you know, quote, had everything. And I sort of do, and I did, and I am very lucky. But yet I was really ill. And I couldn't get my head around this fact that how could I have everything but feel so ill? But that is to misunderstand depression, because depression is an illness. Like, you wouldn't blame yourself if you've got diabetes, or this idea of guilty of dust and sin, but that love bids you welcome. And that if you can hear this other voice of a kind of compassionate voice. So it's really Josephine to Josephine. It's Rachel to Rachel. It's the two voices in your head. And listen to that loving, compassionate voice that accepts you and you're okay just as you are. And you don't have to be this anxious driver and you don't have to keep doing all these things. You're loved just for being you. And this is something that I've tried to sort of, you know, learn really. And every time I go back to Herbert and this idea of acceptance, really, which is what he talks about in his poem. You know, we know about it in science and psychiatrists know about it, is that the moment you can try and accept, you stop fighting what's happening to you and accept it and accept yourself. You know, your stress and your anxiety come down and slowly your depression can come down with it. And very, very slowly you can get back into a much calmer and a kind of accepting place of all our common humanity and our common frailty. And, you know, life often has great challenges, but somehow, you know, we have to learn to love ourselves, and love in the end is how we're going to love other people. And this sense of compassion is where the kind of healing starts.
Wonderful. And tell me the two other parts of the app.
Yeah, so we've got kind of getting better. And then I think the next part, which is sort of allied to getting better, the next lot of poems are really more poems of joy. And one of the things that I found incredibly helpful was the sort of rebirth and renewal of nature and, you know, ecotherapy, getting out there, enjoying nature. And so there's a whole group of poems which celebrate that. There's some Gerard Manley Hopkins, bits of Emily Dickinson. In fact, there's quite a lot of poems. I became very obsessed with little birds, the symbols of hope, because I was still ill, but we do have a little back garden and there was this cheery robin and I would just listen to this robin. There's a lovely Emily Dickinson poem. She's one of my favourite poems, American poet, never published anything in her lifetime. Encouragement for all of us. She's got this poem, Hope is the Thing with Feathers that perches in the soul and it never asks a crumb of me. And it's this sort of image of a little bird. And there's another one called The Darkling Thrush. And it's just this sense of sort of renewal and rebirth, and that, you know, we're part of the kind of natural cycle of things. And we all have our winters, but we have our springs too. So I got very interested in those sort of wonderful celebratory poems. And then the last section of poems are really kind of poems about where I'm sort of at now, which is kind of maintenance and it's managing, and it's like, how do you get up in the morning? And it's dealing with the school run, and it's trying to work, and it's still all the things that we try and do. But somehow the kind of poems that could be your friends and guides through that, anything from sort of If by Rudyard Kipling, which has got an annoying ending. but if you strip out the ending, it's still got a lot of wisdom in it. There's a lovely Raymond Carver one called Happiness, which is about just trying to take pleasure in little things.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous.
I mean, Oscar Wilde said that simple pleasures were the last resort of the complicated man. And I think I've really changed. I used to rush. I was forever rushing. And actually, it happened with the children, because there was this amazing thing, which is that I used to rush their bedtime stories because I was always rushing, and I'd skip.
Yeah.
I'd skip chunks. And my son would know, and he'd say, hang on, you missed a bit. And I'd go, oh, no. And then when I began to get better, I was so thrilled that I was once again able to be a mum and be able to look after my children. And I just remember this moment when I read, I think it was The Very Hungry Caterpillar. I can't remember what it was, Bob the Builder or something. I can't remember which one it was, but I read it slowly. And the whole story. And I loved it. And I just thought, God, why did I rush it? This is just such a wonderful moment. I'm sitting with my, I think he was about three, Edward, and this is what it's about. And it sounds extraordinary. And at the time, it would be ridiculous to say that you could be grateful for depression. But I remember at that moment thinking, oh my God, if I hadn't been ill, I'd have never realised, and I'd have kept on rushing. I'm sitting here with my son, and this is pure gold.
One last question. Why the name Black Rainbow?
Well, I've really struggled with trying to describe depression because, as I say, I just didn't know what it was, and that's why the poems were helpful to me. But one day I was sitting with my son, and I was trying to, our eldest, anyway, I was trying to describe what it was like. And I said, well, you know, it's like a rainbow, because I did feel our life was like a rainbow. It was multicoloured, wonderful things in it, but it had gone black. And I said, it's like a black rainbow. And he said, oh, I'm getting a bit teary now, but Mummy, he said, I mustn't get teary, but anyway, he said, Mummy, he said, rainbows are never black. And I just thought that really summed it up, you know, that underneath the blackness there was still this rainbow, and I would get back to it, and I have. And that's why I'm so passionate about sharing all the strategies and everything I've done, because if it helps one other person, then it's worth it.
Well, so Black Rainbow by Rachel Kelly is published by Yellow Kite. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. It's an absolute privilege, and thank you very much.
Radio Gorgeous, giving you a voice. Why not leave us a voice message? Over to you now. Weekday fix, darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.